sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Market has its biggest sell-off in months. U.S. dollar continues to drive higher. Massive protests in Hong Kong and Bill Gross abruptly departs PIMCO. All this and much more on this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, it's Andrew Horowitz and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Quickly approaching the end of September, the beginning of the final quarter of the year. And we did see one of the biggest sell-offs in the market for the year 2014 last week. A lot of reasons for that we'll talk about. A lot of things to be looking for in the markets in the coming week or so. We have, of course, the new week of the month and the first Friday of the month. And you know what that means? That means employment report. Yeah, we're going to be seeing the employment report and find out exactly how strong that is. That's one of those reports, the economic reports, that is held in very high regard in terms of investors. They want to see what's happening, and around the world, they look at it as a benchmark of what is going on in the U.S. Take out whatever's happening with the ISM manufacturing and factory orders. Take out what's going on even with housing prices. The employment report is the king of all reports. So we're going to be seeing that on Friday. We're going to talk about all the economics shortly, of what to look for in the coming week or so. So the market did have this correction, a 1 or 2 day period where it went down. We saw about a 1.5% knock on the S&P 500. Russell 2000 index had a death cross that came about, I guess it was about a week and a half ago or so, where the 50-day moving average crossed below the 200, which is a sign that momentum is fading very, very quickly. That's something that money managers, hedge funds, and those that are investing with large amounts of money and those that are not, they look at very importantly and they say, hey, you know what? That's something that we're really concerned about. But the question is whether or not that's a precursor to anything or it's really just more aligned with what's going on with the dollar, because the dollar strength that we've been seeing over the last 8, 9, or maybe even 10 weeks now has really been something that should be noticed, because it is not very good for small caps. Small caps don't do well when the dollar, not all the time, but generally speaking, when the dollar is on a rally mode, small caps really haven't in the past done very well. But really, what was the whole sell-off all about? I mean, what was going on? Well, one of the things that I picked out of the news, and what really you can put your finger on if you wanted to find something, aside from, well, valuations were a little bit stretched, and maybe it was a low volume concept because of the Jewish holidays, which, by the way, the sell-off on Thursday, which was on Rosh Hashanah, was actually on pretty good volume. So the commentary that you may hear about it being a market that's pretty sloshy right now and very volatile due to the fact that there is a lower amount of volume that is being applied, or maybe even that a lot of people are on vacation due to holidays and things of that nature, is really kind of not exactly correct. In fact, I would say that the volume that we saw is pretty much on par with what we've seen in the past when we do see sell-offs. See this slow creep higher on just okay volume, and then all of a sudden when you do see a day that sells off, there is a lot more volume that plays out. There's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that When the markets are moving higher and there's a lot of complacency and not much resistance and there's just buyers out there and pushing prices higher, what happens is on a sell-off day, you got both the buyers and the sellers active, right? And what happens then is that you see that the volume spikes. Now, one of the things in the old school is that you want to find where volume is really playing. If volume is being really applied on the up days and not on the down days, well, that's a very bullish sign. If the volume is being applied on the down days and not the up days, well, that's kind of a bearish sign. Well, we haven't seen that many down days of any significance, and for the most part, there's no follow-through on those down days. As we saw last week, on Thursday, there was a 1.5% plus on the S&P, 2% on the NASDAQ, about 2+% on the Russell. Well, on Friday, there was kind of nothing going on in the morning. Then all of a sudden, out of absolutely nowhere, there was this rally that occurred, and the markets were up about 0.75% by the end of the day. Now, just to get back to maybe why the markets are selling off. So there are a lot of reasons out there. One of the things that I thought was very interesting was that there was a news item early on Thursday that talked about how Putin's party from Russia was proposing a law to seize foreign assets. Now, that's really interesting. So a member of Russia's ruling party proposed that a law that would be out there that would allow for the seizure of foreign assets in the country after the U.S. and its various allies have targeted Putin's inner circle, including a childhood friend, with asset freezes and travel bans. Now, this law, the draft of this law, seeks to benefit citizens or companies that have property outside Russia seized under an unlawful judgment from a foreign court. And the government would use budget funds to compensate the victims, and the courts would have the right to go after foreign states' assets in Russia, including property under diplomatic immunity. And this is actually something that I thought was really interesting, because if you think about what happened there, maybe there was a lot of players that said, hey, you know what, we're not willing to have money outside there or inside of Russia, depending on where you were. If you're in Russia, we want to keep it in Russia. If you're outside of Russia, we don't want it in Russia. And what's happening is that possibly the some of the sell-off was due to the fact that this proposal was put forth and there was an advanced concern, and therefore there was this pullback. There was this selling off of assets that would possibly be targeted for seizure. So I think that was probably one of the scarier items in the news that I saw. And if you remember that I've talked about for many, many weeks and months when this is all going on, that eventually the longer that these sanctions that we impose and Europe and various other countries impose on Russia are in effect, and the longer we see these occurring and as they increase and become much more difficult for Russia to do anything, the more knock-on effects and reverberations we're going to find in other countries, because Russia is a major trading partner with many countries around the world. They are an economic superpower. Now, maybe they're not as big as China, clearly, and the U.S., but you know, they are a large component of the global economy. And as such, when these kind of things occur, when you're seeing that the country may in fact go after assets outside of their country, and they may go after the assets of people that are in the U.S., well, there's some spooking that is going on. There's some concern that happens with people that have assets that could be at play. So I think this is a very big issue right now, and this is something that we're going to have to watch for, because this is going to be put into consideration for a law by a committee in the lower house of parliament in Russia on September 29th. And that's tomorrow, Monday. So we'll see what happens on that. And I don't think that some of the add-on stories about this, about how they're going to use the assets, are really of consequence, that they're going to use it for education, healthcare, and all this good stuff. I think really the biggest issue here is that it's back to the theory, and again, this is just a theory that I've been proposing, that Russia is really having a hard time. Russia is really, their banks and their financial systems are essentially seized up, they're illiquid, and they need to find money any way possible. If you recall, I talked about how some of the selling of gold and silver may be partially due to the fact that Russia is selling. I mentioned that there is this potential for commodities to continue to come under pressure the longer these sanctions are on. But once they're lifted, once there is a clearing, once there is some kind of a way out for Russia, that we may see a quick and a very violent turnaround, because right now there is a good amount of folks that are not only selling, but have been on the short side, in particular of gold and silver. Now, if you remember, we always talk about this, that when there's too many on one side of the boat, that what happens to the boat, right? It flips. Well, as this sell-off continues with gold and silver, we're seeing that the gold miners are also selling off. You look at GDX as an example, absolutely obliterated over the last several weeks. The miners, you know, the price of gold, the price of silver is the base component of what they deal with. And as those prices go down, their margin shrinks, their net income profit margin shrinks, and they make less money. The longer it goes on, the worse. If it happens just for a little while, okay, that's fine. But if it's persistent and it does this continuation of lower lows, you start seeing that all of a sudden there's a big concern for those that own those stocks. Now, we have been working with some of these miners recently, buying up the gold miners in an ETF, NUGT Nugget. This is the long gold miners. If you look at that, it has been just blasted. I mean, down 50 or 60% over the last, I don't know, month and a half or so. This is a triple ETF that invests in the gold miners index. And the theory is here that if they are getting to a point of being oversold to a major degree, then the opportunity to buy these companies, these miners, who may shut down some of their smelting operations and mining operations to, you know, hold down their overall costs. And if we do see maybe some of the seasonality that's about to hit in with gold and silver because of the holiday seasons in India, China, this could be very interesting. Not to mention the fact that if we do see that there is some kind of a let up of sanctions, if that happens, or more importantly, if there is some concern in terms of the global geopolitical environment, and there is that desire to run for cover, it could be something interesting here. Now, this is something, again, you know, I'm not a gold bug, but this is something that I've been talking about probably for the last 3 weeks now, and this is something that we've been in and out of, looking for opportunities. And, you know, if it kind of dips too much, we kind of move out, look for a lower price point, buy in, average down a little bit, looking for that pop. So we're looking for that any day now, but it's been a little bit of a rough ride in terms of trying to catch that exact point, because it is a really rough market right now for gold and silver. But again, I think this all ties together with what's going on. I think that besides the fact that you have the dollar as a safe haven and money moving into that, and on top of that, the global economies of the world looking at the U.S. as a place that may be looking to increase rates or at least not continue the excessive amount of stimulus that's been going on, which we've been watching. We know that, of course, at the end of October, we're supposed to see the last of the new bond buying program that we saw, the $85 billion, drop down to $10 billion, and may, in fact, leave us. That brings us right to the economics of what's going to happen next week. So let's talk about that a little bit. It's a very busy calendar for next week. Starting out Monday on the 29th, we got personal income, personal spending. We got the PCE deflator. We're looking at pending home sales, Dallas Fed manufacturing survey, ISM from Milwaukee. Now, what we're looking at here is going to be important, because personal income is one of those things that the Fed watches pretty closely. They want to see that there's wage gains. They want to see that not only is unemployment reducing, but they want to see that there's actually some inflation in wages, because as income goes up, that can benefit the economy. The estimate is for a 0.3 increase on a month over month, whereas it was a 0.2% increase last month, and a 0.4 increase in personal spending. The last month, personal spending dipped. We did see that there was a drop in overall consumer spending last month. Remember that? We talked about how all of a sudden some of the high-end retailers have been dropping off. Look at the Kate Spades and look at the Michael Kors. You know, these have been under pressure. Some of the travel sites have also been under pressure lately. Some of the highly discretionary type of spending stocks have been, you know, definitely feeling some pain. And this is a result of the fact that we're seeing that personal spending has been dropping. Now, even though we're seeing that GDP has been expanding, and GDP expanded about 4.6%, pretty impressive for a developed country, and that's just offsetting the horrific number that we saw in the first quarter. So some of the what was thought to be the weather-related holdbacks, or at least the comparatives, are playing out pretty well. While I think that they extended much of their hope that all things were related to weather in the first quarter, the reality was that it wasn't. There's only so much the weather can hold back people from doing. But the fact is that when we look at the current spending patterns of what's going on right now, clearly we're seeing that there's been some drop. Now, the pickup that we've seen lately in new housing, remarkable blowout last week in terms of new housing starts and new housing sales. Major, major blowout. This is probably why the NAHB, which is the sentiment index for builders, has been peaking out so nicely. A big lull that occurred, if you recall, a few months ago. A lot of concern expressed by the builders. But what we're finding is that a tremendous amount of multifamily housing is going up. Now, what does that mean? Well, it helps out the overall housing index. It helps out the fact that our housing market is healing in a way. I prefer to see single-family homes. That's really what I'm looking for, single-family homes really increasing and in sales. But there's only so much that's going to occur. We're also going to see pending home sales on the 29th, 10 o'clock in the morning. Estimates are for a drop slightly, about a 0.5% drop from the prior month, which was up 3.5%. And year over year, we're looking for about a negative 1.4% when it was a negative 2.7% last month. Some of the more important numbers that we're going to be seeing happened on the 30th, which is going to be Tuesday. We're seeing the Case-Shiller Home Price Index expected to increase ever so slightly overall. But the one that we want to really look at is the 20-city composite year over year. And that's expected to be up 7.35% versus an 8.1% increase in the prior month. Now, one of the things you're also seeing that's really kind of fascinating is that there are certain pockets of areas, particularly in New York, some areas in California, Texas, some in North Dakota, but in Florida. Boy, Florida is on fire. The condos in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, they are fighting over the opportunity to buy a new home. Prices are soaring, and this is pretty much the reason that's given is due to the fact that we have a lot of international buyers, which is true, that are buying in record numbers at the same level that we saw pre-crisis. And the prices of the homes there are, in fact, over levels already. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that you've seen a lot of very expensive condos. Some of the most expensive condos outside of New York are in Miami. Crazy kind of things that are happening. Now, one of the things that's a big difference that we saw in 2005 and 2006 to where we are today is that at least the developers and the condo builders are smarter than they were. Back then, they were taking 10% deposits. And what happened was that as time progressed and they were building and things started slowing down, all of a sudden, those people that put down those deposits said, "The hell with it. I'm done." And now the developers were stuck with this property, which they had large mortgages against and loans to build in the hopes that they were going to sell these deals because they had these things on contracts. They had the deals written down. They knew they had money down on it. But when the buyers not only dried up, but when the buyers backed out and just said, "Hey, keep my deposit. I don't give a crap." No buyer stepped up behind them. That was the big difference. Now, they're requiring like 70% down. That's a big difference. Think about that. 70% down or so versus 10% down. At 70% down, if you walk away, they're really not on the hook for much. Even if they get a buyer at a much lower level, they're still in good shape. And you are not going to walk away, or I, if I have 70% down. That's a much different dynamic than when I had 10% down. It's much easier to walk away from that. So we're also going to see consumer confidence Consumer confidence has been doing very well in terms of the University of Michigan. And we're going to see the official consumer confidence index on Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning. 92.5 is the number we're looking for, slightly above last month. That is going to be followed up by, on Wednesday in the morning, ADP employment, expecting to have about 207,000 private jobs added to the payrolls, which is about where we've been. We've seen that the initial claims over the last week or so, maybe 3 weeks, have been sub 300,000, and that's good. That is, it's doing well for employment, and we should see a pretty good employment number. It's interesting, though, that last month we were slightly disappointed. Remember, we did see the unemployment rate was dropping, but we only had a much smaller amount, only about about 135,000 new private payrolls added last month, when we expected in the 200,000 range. So the change in non-farm payrolls is expected to be about 215. That's on Friday. And we're expecting a 6.1% unemployment rate. Again, with that report, we also get average hourly earnings, looking to stay about 0.2% up. And the average work week, the hours work, about 34.5. Labor force participation rate is going to stay probably a bit steady. And then we're going to also see the ISM non-manufacturing composite, which is going to expect it to dip slightly. The service index going to dip down to about 58.5. And before that, that's on Friday. On Wednesday, we'll see the ISM manufacturing, which is expected to be about the same, 58 and change. Now, over 50 is expansion. Under 50 is contraction. We've seen that China is right on the edge. The latest report was about 50-ish. Their flash numbers and their manufacturing numbers are right at the point of bending towards contraction versus expansion. And this is after they ran up after a big lull in the beginning of the year. Some of the mini stimulus that was applied, some of the money that was provided to the banks to help liquidity, and the loans that were giving out, and the infrastructure development, et cetera, did help the overall Chinese manufacturing numbers. But one of the things that's happening in China, at least an offshoot, is a couple of things. We have, first of all, that there's been a big drop in the visits to Macau, especially because there's a lot of threats that are going on to really spooking the VIPs there that would usually go, and all sorts of taxes and questions and things that are going on there. And interestingly enough, we're seeing a lot of slack in Las Vegas Sands. Wynn, that's been doing okay. They have a bit more of a footprint around the country. But don't forget that you also have a lot of things happening with the concern about Atlantic City. That Atlantic City was seeing several bankruptcies of major casinos, including Trump, because it's not the only game in town anymore. It used to be what? Reno, Las Vegas, and Atlantic City. That was it, right? That was the only place you could really do any major gambling. Yeah, you could do some highlay and some off-track betting kind of things in New York, you could in Florida. You could do the dog track, the racetrack, but there really wasn't anything more than that in terms of table games or even looking at some slots. But what has happened? Well, what has happened is that mega facilities have opened up around the country on Indian territory. And as a matter of fact, this weekend I was at the Hard Rock Cafe, or the Hard Rock, what is it called? The Hard Rock, not the cafe, the Hard Rock Casino, Seminole Casino. And I was there for a charitable event. And wandered away from the event and checked out the casino. It was packed. I mean, it was just jam-packed. And one of the reasons was that Foreigner was playing that night. But aside from that, I've been there before for different events and things of that nature, and it's usually pretty crowded. They're building it and expanding it. And this is, by the way, in the middle of nowhere. This is in Fort Lauderdale all the way west. It's not in the middle of, like, by the beach. It's not anywhere that you'd want to go necessarily for a place to hang out. It's kind of a seedy area. And it's one casino. It's not like a strip. There's no other destination really here. But it's packed. And the tables aren't like your $1 and $2 tables. They're $20 tables. So this time when I was in there, I noticed there was more slot machines than I've ever seen. Plus these very strange games. Like, for example, not only do they have the blackjack and the three-card poker and the craps and all that, but they had, like, virtual craps. So you sit around a table, you have a big center that has two dice, and you place your bets on a little computer thing. And instead of anybody rolling, the dice just kind of roll around, and then they pay off in the computer. Nobody's like, none of the fun that you saw with somebody like spitting or breathing or kissing the dice or any of those kind of great things. Nobody's sitting around a table bending over. It's just all computer operated. Same thing happens with blackjack and roulette. I don't know what the fun of that is. It seems more fun to have the mechanical games to me. Maybe I'm just old school. I don't know. But anyway, this is something that's you know, obviously aiding the casinos, because anytime they can get a little bit of an edge in terms of the odds in their favor, it's beneficial. But again, my point here is that these type of facilities that are not in Atlantic City, Vegas, and those are the two majors, I do wonder what's going to be happening with these casino companies if they don't, in fact, embrace and get involved with some of the Indian type of casinos around the country. They have. Many of them have. You know, you've also seen, obviously, the companies like Shuffle Master, which was bought, and Bally, and the various companies that are selling the slot machines. You know, they're obviously in there anyway, regardless of who owns the particular casino. But this is something we're going to see. I think it will be very interesting to watch for Las Vegas Sands, which is a great company and a win. So keep your eye on that over the next little while. I think that's going to be very interesting to watch what happens as we see this concern in Macau, which is the biggest gaming hub in the world. But then again, we're getting other places. You know, the Philippines is opening up gaming. We see that in Singapore there's gaming. Around the world, Japan's even considering it at this point. You know, one of the big things is they realize it's a major tax benefit to the states and to the countries that have gaming. We don't even talk about Monte Carlo anymore, do we? That was like the place. That was like your James Bond kind of, hey, Monte Carlo, you've been there? So it's pretty cool. Kind of strange rules there. You know, when you play blackjack, like, you can have a line behind you if you're sitting at the table, and the players behind you can actually be playing and betting on your play. A little nerve-wracking, because not only you have to pull the card for yourself, you kind of feel obligated, and you feel like the people behind you are playing with you, and you don't want to make a mistake. But anyway, this is a very, very interesting time for, I think, the casino companies, and we're going to keep a watch on those names that are out there. Now, with the dollar increasing, the big question is, what companies, who out there can benefit, and who's going to be hurt? We did a study that I thought was really interesting. We looked at the companies out there, major companies out there, that had a very big exposure to revenue from anywhere outside the U.S. Because if you think about this, if they're going to be looking at consumers and other buyers of goods. So you have a U.S. company who is going to be selling. They're going to be selling their product to someone. Now, if they're selling to someone in the U.S., okay, that's fine. Now, what if they're going to be selling outside the U.S.? The dollar has now increased, let's call it, you know, 7% against the yen, 7% or so against the euro. Now, all of a sudden, their products become much more expensive if they're doing a lot of distribution and sales outside the U.S. to those areas. So we took a look at those companies that had a massive amount of their revenue that was outside the U.S. And let me give you some of these names. Take out a pencil, pen, or iPad, or whatever you're going to write it down with, and listen to this. So those companies that had at least a 20% of their revenue outside the U.S. in Europe or and in Asia. So for example, let's take a look at DuPont. DuPont has about 21.5% of their revenue comes from Europe and that region, and about 21% of their revenue comes from Asia. About 40% or so of their money comes from outside the U.S. Philip Morris, about 60% comes from Europe and about 30% from Asia. Close to about 90% of Philip Morris's income revenue is outside the U.S. This is a U.S. company, and now all of a sudden their price of their product gets much higher for those that are trying to buy it. McDonald's, 40% Europe, 23% in Asia. Some of the other big ones, Intel, but I'm not going to really count Intel because Intel, they're buying their product and also manufacturing it overseas. About almost 100% of their product revenue is outside the U.S., which I think is interesting. But don't forget, they're selling it to foreign companies, then we're buying it back. So that doesn't really count because we're able to buy it back from those at a lower price. So let's kind of just want to mention those, that one, but I thought it was interesting. Caterpillar. Now, Caterpillar, you know that I always talk about if the dollar rises, they have a lot of competition outside the U.S. They have competition with a lot of companies in Asia in particular. Now, Caterpillar gets about 23% of their revenue from Europe and about 20% of their revenue from Asia. That's one of the reasons that Caterpillar has been dropping. Apple, again, kind of in line with Intel, about 22% of their revenue comes from the European region and about 28% from Asia. IBM, 32%. Europe, 21% in Asia. There's a couple others that stuck out to me that I thought were interesting. Altera, but these again are chip. Some of the technology companies don't weight them as heavily in this discussion. 27% in Europe, 57% in Asia. But let's talk about some of the ones that are also important. McDonald's, 41% Europe, 23%. That was one we mentioned. That's something that's important. 3D Systems, 27% in Europe, 20% in Asia. Let's see what else we've got on this list that's not technology-related or absolute technology. Expeditors, 21% in Europe and 47% in Asia. So I think these are companies that you want to kind of keep a watch on. Those companies that have a dramatic amount of income from that. Sealed Air, 32%, for example, Europe. That's something to watch. Estee Lauder, 41% Europe. Coca-Cola, about 40% Europe. Let's see what else we have on the list that's non-related to Mylan Labs, 27% Europe. Ford, 24% Europe. Let's see what else we got here. This is also more, 52%. Schlumberger, 52% in Europe. TripAdvisor, 33% in Europe. And Abercrombie & Fitch, 27%. Now, in terms of, I think that overall, we need to keep an eye on those. Asia, we also have a couple of them that are interesting to look at. I think that you should keep your eye on. Tiffany, 35% in Asia. Aflac, this is one you want to watch because Aflac, when that yen, it's good for them to have the yen drop in value, but also this is an interesting one because it could be problematic. They had problems when you saw they had such a big portfolio of European bonds. I like to watch Aflac and be looking at them from the consideration of what their holdings are. They're an insurance company, and they have a tremendous amount of business in Asia, but also a tremendous amount of holdings in Europe. Let's see. Wynn, 68% in Asia. MGM, 33% in Asia. Las Vegas Sands, 86%. We just talked about that a little while ago. Cliffs Natural, 21%. Herbalife, 36% Asia. GT Advanced Technology, but that's they make some of the sapphire screens and things of that nature for various smartphone companies. 91%. Let's see if there's anything else on this list here. Asia. Looking through this list. What do I see here? International Rectifier, they were bought, so we're not going to count them. Yum Brands, 54% Asia, we know about that. Kimberly-Clark, 38% in Asia. And we'll finish it off with, see who else is on this list that's important. Mead Johnson Nutrition, 72% in Asia. So those names are some that you should be keeping a look at, because if you continue to see dollar strength, this could become a very significant headwind for these companies. So keep that in mind in terms of investing. They've really benefited from the weaker dollar for some time, and this is going to be a problem for them moving forward. Well, let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the bond market. Now, we talked about how the Fed has been talking back and forth about whether they're going to slow down their purchases of the bonds, or whether they're going to, continue with stimulus dependent on the data and all that. Well, the Fed balance sheet is now about $4.2 trillion. Lots of bonds they bought. One of the things that has been a big concern of people is, well, what's going to break this whole bond, quote-unquote, bubble? What's going to happen if, in fact, rates rise? What would make rates rise? And we really haven't seen a significant amount of upward bias in rates at all. Because each time we see that there's good economic news, they may dip a little bit, but still everybody thinks, the Fed's still buying. At least they're buying some. But liquidity has dropped out of the market a bit. Now, if they start to pull back ever, or let it just naturally drain off is a big question. Probably they're never going to pull back, but they're just going to let the bonds naturally just bleed out over time. What would be that catalyst, though, that we would see that there would be a sell-off in bonds? Would it be just such a dramatic move in the economics, which we've seen? I mean, we're seeing that right now, right? We're seeing that a 4.6% GDP, we're seeing that 6.1% unemployment, we're seeing that manufacturing is good, ISM numbers are good, factory orders are good. I mean, the list goes on and on. Things are okay in the U.S. We're healing. What could it be? Well, one of the things that really was, I think, a very big news item that needs to be taken very seriously is the abrupt departure by Bill Gross from PIMCO last week. Now, we know since the beginning of the year there's been some problems. Something's been going on. Mohammed Al-Aryan had resigned of his post. He was CEO and the gent who really helped to insert PIMCO not only on the bond map, but on the equity front as well. And he left. And there was a bit of a discussion about how he wasn't getting along with Bill Gross, and there were some problems there. There were some differences that they felt that they could no longer deal with, and he left. And then we heard some other things. There was about 11 months of withdrawals, net withdrawals, and redemptions from the PIMCO Total Return Fund, the flagship fund, billions of dollars. I mean, the biggest bond fund out there, Bill Gross being the bond guru of all gurus. And there was a lot of money coming out. He had to defend himself all the time. There was a lot of questions. What was going on there? What was happening internally? We actually brought down our exposure. We like the PIMCO Total Return Fund for our global allocations, but we brought down our allocation over the last many months. And as a matter of fact, sold out the position when we heard the news of Bill Gross leaving. Now, it wasn't necessarily only due to the fact that Bill Gross was leaving. That was one thing. But it was really, what did that mean? Because a lot of people put faith in the whole PIMCO discussion and their history because Bill Gross was there. Now, with all the things, if you add them up, not only do you have a management change and you have a new manager coming in of this fund, but the abrupt departure that was in addition to all the things that went on with regard to the scuttlebutt about what was happening there. And I started thinking about this and I'm wondering, this must be more. There's got to be more. What could it be? Is it possible that something's happening with Bill Gross' mental capacity? I don't know. But it sure smells like that. It seems like something's going on that all of a sudden, over the last year or so, that people that he was working with in his management team, which all threatened to resign recently, unless Bill Gross was ousted. And before PIMCO could oust Bill Gross, he took it upon himself to go look around. He contacted some of the major bond fund ETFs and managers out there to see if they were looking for somebody. And I thought that was really interesting. Now, he left without a severance, without a package, he did not have a non-compete in play, nothing. He just left. And this is a company that he founded. You don't just leave a company that you founded, okay? Something is going on very wrong there. And his abrupt departure was clearly the sign that we needed to kind of close the rest of our position. And to add to that now and bring back the discussion of what would it take for the bond market, I wonder how many other players are going to be moving out of the PIMCO Total Return Fund. And with a bond market that's less liquid than it was and the high amount of treasuries that is owned by the PIMCO Total Return Fund, I do wonder what it's going to be like trying to sell some bonds. How much illiquidity is going to be out there if someone is actually going to try to make a big sale of bonds? You know, the incremental buyers of treasuries was the Fed and the bond funds that are out there, the hedge funds, pension funds. A lot of them invested through PIMCO. And now that the guru is no longer at the helm, giving a good deal of comfort to those who are buying bonds, not knowing what the overall strategy is going to be because of this very quick departure. Now, there was a backup plan, of course, that PIMCO had, and PIMCO then appointed managers already, of course, et cetera. But, you know, this is not a normal flow of events, especially for a major firm like this. Now, where he goes and what he does is not the point. I'm more concerned about what's going to happen with the selling on this news. Now, I'd watch in particular one of the funds that has been under investigation due to improper pricing of their bonds to bring up performance, which is the total return ETF, not the mutual fund, much smaller version. The total return ETF, the symbol is BOND, bond. And put that on your radar. Watch that. Put it on your watch list. Let's see what happens there. Because mutual funds are priced at the net asset value of the valuation of the bonds, etc. And that's all there is to it. An ETF, since it's traded actively, is priced at not only at the net asset value, but also it can be at a premium or a discount. And what can happen here is that if there is a lot of potential selling that will go on, all of a sudden the potential of liquidity is much different because there's a fixed amount of shares essentially. So what's going to happen with an ETF may not happen with a mutual fund, but still, if there is a lot of selling in the treasury side of this, and that's a big holding of the total return mutual fund, and if there is a lot of people who will start to walk away from this because of a concern of, you know, they don't know what's going to happen, they can look for something better or something comparable. Now, obviously, when they do that, they're going to be selling one and buying another, but we're not necessarily sure that it's going to be a like-kind exchange, if you will. We're not necessarily sure they're going to move from, you know, the PIMCO total return, which has, you know, X securities in it, to another fund or another investment that has a very similar portfolio. Maybe, you know, somewhat similar, but not totally similar. And therefore, there's going to be a bunch of the bonds underlying it that are going to be sold. And if that's the case, you know, they may be left with only the illiquid ones. And then you're going to see a discount on your ETF. I would not be owning the bond ETF or the BOND symbol ETF right now. I think it's a very big risk. And I wonder if this is going to cause a major problem due to the fact that just selling is going on, even if it's swapped out immediately to another one. But the effect of just selling is going to force the manager of PIMCO to really see a lot of withdrawals, have to make a lot of sales, and really do something very significant that sparks a bond sell-off. We'll see. But keep that on your radar. This could be one of those things that everybody was looking for, like, hey, when is it going to happen? What's going to be the catalyst? What's going to do it? This could be the situation that absolutely provides a major catalyst, an initial catalyst for the sell-off, on top of the fact that the dollar's going higher, on top of the fact that you're seeing that the Fed is taking their foot off the pedal, and this could be an issue. Now, don't forget, the Fed with their $4.5 trillion or $4.25 trillion of assets doesn't want to see the bond market sell off, and they don't want to see rates higher. Just moving rates higher by 0.5% on the 10-year is going to be major damage for the Fed. Major damage to their balance sheet. Not only will the underlying securities be priced down, but then if they have to, you know, the cost potentially of, if they do buy any further, the cost potentially of buying and the income they'll receive, you know, on this, on the, and the cost for the U.S. government on issuing new debt, where they're issuing it now at, you know, let's call it a very extremely low rate. I mean, ridiculously low rates. If they have to now start issuing debt at a higher rate, you know, the whole Fed and the government's going to have a real problem on their hands. Keep your eye on bonds. Again, I'm not saying this is going to be the sell-off, but you know what? Let's really be honest. Let's just stop and say that the bond rates today and where we are not at all aligned with where we are on an economic basis. Now, you could say all you want that stocks are overpriced or underpriced, but you know what? Those have a lot more room to move due to a lot more factors than bonds. Bonds are being kept down artificially. There's no question about that. The bond market is absolutely being controlled by the Fed. And the fact is that it's good for the Fed and it's good for the government to keep bond prices where they are. If in fact there is a sell-off, do they go in and you know, once again start some new stimulus because they don't want? I mean, if you had the ability to basically make the market in a security or a sector or an asset class, you wouldn't want to see it selling off. You would do whatever you can, especially if you had unlimited funds. I mean, just money you could just take out of midair and buy them. So I do wonder what's going to happen with that. And if the Fed does start another stimulus plan, forget about stocks. We're not talking about that. For the fact that they want to actually keep their buying going on because there is illiquidity, I'm not sure how that's going to play out. Already we're seeing that with Europe and Mario Draghi stating that he will do anything, everything, and just more than that. So the euro dropping pretty significantly, and that benefiting the potential for inflation in that country by raising it. Of course, the dollar moving higher is good to keep inflation down, but of course they don't want to keep inflation down. They're trying to boost inflation, so that's not going to work. So there's going to be, you know, really back to currency wars again, the race to the bottom with what's going to happen in terms of how we're going to see the dollar react to the euro. All this is going to come into play, and there's going to be an absolutely tremendous clash of the U.S., the dollar, Europe, euro, and the Japanese yen. There's going to be a major crash and a collision here. And I got to tell you something, it's going to really not be good for the emerging markets. I can't see any real benefit here with what's going on right now for the emerging markets at all. So keep your eyes on that, because you know we keep on raising the dollar value. Their currencies go down. That's inflationary. They have an inflation problem to begin with. They're not going to be able to really buy our products. We'll buy their products, but we're not going to be able to buy our products. So this whole thing gets very, very messy, which leads me back to why you want to probably be in gold and things like that right now on top of some of the quality stocks that you have known to, you know, love and care for. Let's talk about what's going on in Hong Kong. Protests. Kind of reminds me, I don't know if you watch this, kind of reminds me of Tiananmen Square. What happened years ago when pro-democracy activists and students, this was in China, but that was in China. This is in Hong Kong, a little bit different. But there's protests going on. As a matter of fact, this is being led very similarly to Tiananmen Square by pro-democracy. And they're really up in arms about some of the things that are going to happen a number of years from now and some of the things that have been recently put on the slate and who would be controlling Hong Kong, et cetera. And the Chinese government now has been firing tear gas into the crowds, and that's just pissing them off even more. The crowds are getting denser. Big protests going on. The government now says, hey, you know what? We're going to send the army in. Well, that's not going to be good. I don't know if now is any different than it was before. Before, when Tiananmen Square was going on, you know, there really wasn't there was no internet to speak of. There was no mass communication, social media, etc. Now you have all that going on, and now you have it in Hong Kong, not in China. Much different dynamic there, much different culture, and a much different openness in terms of the differential between then and now, and especially in Hong Kong. So this is something also that is a flashpoint in the world, and it comes after all these interesting discussions about what the world wants and the fact that we recently had this Clinton confab that went on, and everybody's talking about not only in the UN the whole weather issues, but also in this Clinton deal, everybody's talking about the income and wage inequity, wealth inequity, not only in the U.S. but around the world. Which, you know, again, the Fed is causing a lot of this. The central banks are causing this. You know, you can't just do what they're doing without causing some other effects. But, you know, there's going to be this great time when there's going to be, companies once again are going to care about the employees and not care about the bottom line. And I don't know when that happens. I don't know why that happens. They cited like two or three companies. Oh, look at Costco. Costco is one of those companies that never cared about necessarily the bottom line. It's all about the employees and all that. That's one company, and they care about the bottom line, by the way. Let's not kind of get a little bit carried away with this. They care about the bottom line. Companies do, because they have management teams. They have shareholders. Now, if you haven't listened to our recent discussion about this, about three or four podcasts ago, it's something you really should listen to. But this whole idea that the world is changing, and social media is taking over and doing, you know, this is good and it's bad. It's good because there's a lot more transparency, openness, and availability of things for people around the world that didn't have it before. But on the other side, one of the problems is that people are saying, hey, wait a minute, let me take a look at social media. Look at these people have over here. I don't have that. That causes problems. Already China, for example, which was the place that you would go to find all your manufacturing some time ago, they're leaving. Major companies leaving there. They're going to the Philippines. They're going to places around the world that aren't as expensive. Why is that? Well, as people in China got a wind of all the things that were available to them and they're working really hard making nothing, they said, you know what? We want benefits. Yeah, it didn't work for a while, but it started working. We want higher wages. We don't want to work in bad conditions. We want air conditioning in our house. We don't have it. We want running water. All the things that they should have. Well, what happens with that is that the, you know, companies all of a sudden are pressed. They got to give vacation time. They got to give health benefits. You got to give time off for sick. They got to work normal hours. They got to get better wages. All these things increase the overall cost of doing business. And as we are so focused on the bottom line in manufacturing and in production and sales around the world, not only here, but around the world, we take the manufacturing from those countries, move it somewhere else because we're not going to take it. We're not going to say, you know what, we're willing to, yeah, great. We're willing to pay those prices because at the end of the day, consumers here want the lowest prices possible for common goods. And I'm not talking about the Tiffany's. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about mass-produced goods. So it ends up being a big problem overall for, you know, those countries that it's a natural progression. You know, we've seen it before. It happened in India, went to China. China went to Philippines. Where next? I don't know. Back to Latin America, Mexico again or somewhere. I'm not sure where. Or other countries around Asia that are less developed that potentially could see the availability of, you know, labor that's very, very cheap. Something that's not going to change. Now, maybe if we exhaust all the possibilities of labor, maybe then we'll see, you know, that things will start to get a little bit better. But at the same time, that means that we're going to have to be paying higher prices. And that's going to be a roadblock to all of that. So this week I would be watching the movement of, we'll say that window dressing on Monday, because Tuesday is the end of the quarter. A lot of times mutual funds and hedge fund managers, they want to sell off the stuff that isn't working, buy the stuff that is working so they could show a nice, pretty balance sheet and portfolio holdings to their clients. And that often happens at the end of the quarter, end of the month too, but end of the quarter. It probably should have been, it probably happened already on Friday, Thursday. We'll see how it plays out into Monday and Tuesday of next week. Then we go for the end of the year. We got that end of the year rush. We'll see that we have probably a good amount of you know, optimism for a Santa Claus rally, for an end of year rally that will be occurring. But excuse me. On the other hand, I think some of these issues with the Fed and some of the finality of where they're going to be with their stimulus programs, et cetera, are going to really be playing pretty hard. So I would watch for volatility to come up significantly over the next few weeks, but particularly for the next week into Wednesday and Thursday into the number. Now, what will happen if we see a certain number in the unemployment rate and the new jobs added? Is it going to be, you know, the buy the bad news and sell the good news? Possibly. But I think that right now we are in a very interesting point that there are a lot of players that are finally trying to buy the economy for the good news and the bad news, with the realization that the Fed isn't going to necessarily step in and add, they may not pull away, but not add, is going to be a you know, that's going to be an overriding issue right now. So if we see a negative situation where you see maybe, let's see, the unemployment rate tick up surprisingly, I don't know why that would happen, but maybe. Maybe that you don't have as many jobs added. Maybe it's only, let's call it 150,000. That'd be 2 months in a row. That's a problem. That'd be 2 months in a row that we're seeing that there is a, you know, a real disappointment in overall numbers. Now, the other thing that I want to mention to you is that the Hindenburg omen, something that, you know, technical indicators are technical indicators. You know, you take them with a grain of salt. But there is a couple of them that you'll want to look at sometimes because they have a tendency to play out because of what they're tracking. Now, the Hindenburg omen, you've heard me talk about this over time. It doesn't happen quite often. and it doesn't always confirm. We had this partially confirm about a year ago, I think it was. But the last time it confirmed, in terms of the most conservative definition, was in 2007, right before things start to really get hairy. Now, this is a combination of technical signals that together forecast the likelihood of a stock market crash. The inputs are the 10-week simple moving average of the market, new 52-week highs of the New York Stock Exchange, 52-week lows of the New York Stock Exchange, and the McClellan Oscillator. Now, if on the same day the 10-week moving average is rising, new highs are greater than 2% of total issues traded, new lows are greater than 2.2% of total issues traded, and the McClellan Oscillator is negative, then a Hindenburg signal is indicated. Now, if we get two of those within a 36-day period, it's considered the Hindenburg omen and is indicated by a red diamond. And what that means is, on this chart that I'll put this chart up, by the way, you'll see this. Watch for the yellows and the reds. Now, if in fact we get this confirmation, two signals within a 36-day period, it says that, now this is the Hindenburg omen, says that a serious decline will occur within 40 days. Now, where they got all these numbers and where this all came about and how this played out, because it doesn't happen that often, is anyone's guess. But supposedly, this is something that is watched and this is something that you need to pay attention to. And like I said, there's been plenty of times that we saw this Hindenburg signal come into play, but not confirmed by two of them within a 36-day period. And again, the last time that happened was 2007. What do you do about this? Keep it in the back. File it away. Don't file it too far, but file it away. Something that you know about. That here we are, 40 days from about, let's call it middle of September. So let's call it to the end of October. It's time that there could be a serious decline that forms in the markets. Crashed, correction, whatever it may be. We haven't had one in a while, and with all the things that are going on, not only geopolitically, but also with the Fed, etc., this could be actually something that we want to pay attention to. We'll keep you updated with that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Of course, you can find all things that are very interesting, including the DH Unplugged podcast, etc. Stocktoberfest starts this week. Keep an eye on that. And if you have any questions, you know where to find me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's it for this show. Thanks for joining me. If you have any questions at all, just reach out. I'm here for you. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.